May the words of our mouths and the meditations in our hearts be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.
Amen.
Today and next Sunday, I'll do a teaching here on our relationship with the Muslim religion. And people would say, well, why would you do that in church? That's simply a purely political matter. Well, no, it really isn't just a purely political matter. Of course, it is political, but we need to be totally informed because, for one reason, and there are many reasons, but for one reason, in the Muslim religion, there is no separation between church and state. And so, when the majority of people in a country are of the Muslim faith, that faith translates into political power, and the political leaders are guided by the Muslim religion in what they do. And therefore, it's important, since the Mohammedan religion is now one of the major world religions. So we've got to take that seriously and understand a great deal of what they intend to do and what they mean to do. And again, I will, as I did last Sunday, separate the teachings of the Episcopal Church about this, on the one hand, and some of my own personal opinions. And when I try to give a personal opinion, I will identify it as such, so you can throw it in the wastebasket if you so choose. Now, let's go back a little bit. Scholars have researched pretty carefully the Near East, all through those countries that we now know of as Saudi Arabia, Egypt, all across North Africa, and then going west, Iraq, Iran, and all of that, all the way over to India and beyond. Now, scholars have said that somehow or another, some scholars can trace this back further than simply the time I'm going to talk about. But at the point about 2000 BC, they said it's as if there were like three holes in the ground, and periodically there comes out of those holes a whole mass of people at one time in three separate places. And one of those is in the desert of Saudi Arabia. Another one would be in the up north of India, what's called the Caucasus Mountains, and that gave birth to another separate group, and still another one would be down in Central Africa. And so we look at that, and periodically, and probably it was because in all of those regions there would periodically be a famine, and people would get hungry and start dying, and so they would come out of their tribal area and attack those places where there was food. And there was food in three places where a former migration from those three holes in the ground had come, and the migration with that, and they would always go to the great river valleys where there would be food. And those river valleys would be along the Indus River, way over in India, and then the Tigris and Euphrates River in Iraq today, where Baghdad is, and then the Jordan River. That was a real small one, not very important, but it was still there in a fertile ground, and then the Nile River in Egypt. And so those people would converge, and whatever people had been there earlier than that, they would come in and attack. And most of the people, particularly those that would come out of the desert in Arabia, were rather primitive tribal people who knew a good bit about settling things with violence. Now, that, at the time about 2000 BC, those people that had come out of those areas and had settled and attacked the people who already were there in the river valley, this meant that the predominance of of the River Valley civilizations were in Egypt and in Persia and around Baghdad in the Tigris-Euphrates area, and to a lesser degree in what we now call Palestine, the Canaanite people in the Bible. Then around 1200, there was another eruption from, particularly from Saudi Arabia, and these people came out of the desert and attacked, and we know from the book of Genesis and Exodus that they, some of them went down to Egypt and attacked the people there, but they lost that, and the people who were already there sort of conquered those people that came from Saudi Arabia. But the ones who came out and went toward the Jordan, fertile valleys along the Jordan River, in what today we call Palestine, those people were successful, and they beat the Canaanites, and they settled there, and they moved from their kind of economy of a desert tribal religion and began to move into more agriculture, as many of the books in the Old Testament, particularly the book of Deuteronomy, is all filled with rules and laws about how you should run agriculture and share your crops with those who have none. Now, that went along, and the Christian civilization dominated that area after Christianity moved into there, on up until around in the 6th century, the late 500s. Now, you know from your high school studies, going back somewhere between 500 and 600, 700, all the way on up for probably 600 or 700 years, what we call in Europe the Middle Ages, or we were in the Dark Ages. Our civilization was very low, not very very prosperous, and also not very intellectually very alert. But then around 570, a man from that was from the tribes in Saudi Arabia, tribal area, named Muhammad, he arose and became an itinerant preacher, kind of a mystic. He went off by himself and meditated, and then he would come back and start talking and saying, "The Lord has told me thus and so should do." And some of it was written down in the book called the Quran. And that's the scriptures of that. And it is held by most Muslims, not all, but most Muslims today, to be infallible and the word of God for all people who believe in that. Now, it's very interesting what happened when Muhammad, came into a little village called Mecca, and he talked to the people of Mecca, and a lot of them decided that he had a clue to what God was all about. And he would get it written down in the Quran. Now then, took place was some of the people there wanted to chase him out. So he went over to a neighboring village called Medina. And this is where you see in the news all the time, a lot of times there will be a pilgrimage from Mecca to Medina. And those were the two holy places at first. But here's the interesting thing about this. Muhammad, coming from an Arabian tribe, was quite accustomed to the use of violence in settling disputes. And he was very successful with that. And he created an army at first. And he eventually he wanted to try to have a peaceful sort of religion for sure. But at early stages, when the people in Mecca were against him, then he took up the sword and created an army. And he was very successful. Now he is a tribal person in a little town in Arabia. But his army grew, and he moved in various different directions, and within 100 years, the Muslim religion and its rulers now were all the way over into Spain, all across North Africa, You see, that's, you see it today. These are all Arabic descending people in those countries. And on the other side, it went up into what is now Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, which didn't exist as a country then, but all the way over through India and into the little islands of off near Tumuva, almost to the Philippines. That's a huge empire. Now, that period then was extremely important. And I want to bring up just a couple of the words, because these are going to be more and more in the news. This is a religious figure. But it was a religious figure who also had political power as well. It's called the Caliph. And the Caliph was at first at Mecca and Medina there in the desert. But as they had went and conquered territories around the great rivers, like the Tigris-Euphrates, where Baghdad is, and that became, where the seat of power was, is called the Caliphate, from the Caliph who lived there. And he was, in a sense, totally in charge with the backing of his religion and the use of the sword. He set up the laws. And the Arabic language became a holy language. Like, for instance, for many, many years, after no one spoke Latin in the Roman Catholic Church, Latin at the Sunday morning Mass in the Roman Catholic Church, up until our own century, last century, was in Latin. And now all of the liturgy and all of the religious rituals were in Arabic. Though a lot of these countries never spoke Arabic. But they were all descendants of Arabs. For a long time they were, in places like Iraq and today Lebanon and those countries, Iran. No, not Iran. It's very interesting. There was another movement of people, another eruption coming out of the Caucasus Mountains. These are Caucasians. You and I mostly are Caucasian people. Although the African-American people come from a different, as we say, hole in the ground. We came out of that. And the people who occupied what today is called Iran, then it was called Persia, those people were Caucasians. And they had to, their liturgy was going to be in Arabic because they were conquered by the Arabian people. But they didn't speak Arabic at first, and they were not Arabs as such. This is an important difference. These people are Caucasians like us. They would be our ancestors, really. Toward the end of, after Muhammad had died, then he didn't make any plans as to who would take his place as being the Caliph. And so then there was an argument between the two. And two groups set up, and you will see them today because they're very powerful today. We don't understand it. People say, well, what's the difference between them? It's hard to tell the difference between them, but they have a sense of what the difference is. And these are the Sunni people. Now, all of this took place in Arabia first. The Sunni people and the Shia people, Shiites. And those people separated two parties. One was said that the successors of Muhammad needed to be people who were related to his family. And that would be the Shiites. And the other people said it would be his disciples and the ones who became after the disciples and related to the disciples. Not blood kin, but disciples. And these are the Sunnis. And they are mixed together in a lot of countries. And for instance, you don't get very much of this in our press. You don't get very much about this right now. But the truth of the matter is, in Iraq, which we withdrew all of our forces and felt that we had settled the war in that by getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Well, right now, the Sunnis and the Shias in Iraq are at war with one another, and it's not unusual for sometimes you'll see it on the back page of the newspaper that 100 people have been killed by one group or another. So there's a lot of revolution going on in the country we thought we had brought a measure of democracy to. In the Quran, there's a word, jihad, and jihad means defense. And at first, Muhammad said that he had conquered so much of this territory that you will not use any kind of jihad as an aggressive war that you start. You can only do, if you are attacked, then you can go to war to defend yourself. But it got so that it spread. And in a couple of hundred years, some of the scholars would write that if you felt there was an enemy, then you could, that even though they weren't attacking you at the moment, they were your enemy, and they probably will attack, so you could do a preemptive first strike against them. That's our language. It's kind of in the Western world now. So that was widening the word jihad to meaning you could attack people that were not, they might likely be against you ahead of time. Another thing that came out of the Quran, he would issue edicts as to what ought to be done and the role of women in society and so forth. And this became law, and the law is called Sharia. And it is very strict. The Sharia law is very, if you think an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is pretty strict, that's nothing compared to Sharia. And it is a very, this is where we get from the Sharia, where, and people who are devout Muhammadans would like to reinstitute Sharia-type law. This is what the Taliban rose to power over in, coming out of Pakistan and into Afghanistan, and they introduced Sharia law. This is where women, for instance, who did something wrong, they would cut their hands off if they stole something. And finally, if they didn't behave themselves properly, they could be shot. Killed. Now, what about Jews and Christians who lived in those areas? Since both Judaism and Christianity was in existence there in those countries before the Muslim religion started. Well, at first, what Muhammad and his followers did was say, we will allocate a couple of villages on the coastline of Saudi Arabia, and Christians and Jews can live there, but nowhere else in Arabia. I mention that to you because it's going to come out next Sunday. That's going to end up being pretty important for them. Now, here's an interesting thing. While Western civilization was going into what we think of as the Dark Ages, because the people from the Caucasus Mountains came across in tribes in the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th, and 10th centuries. And it was a pretty crude, rough type of civilization in France, in what now is Germany, and in England. This is where we get Anglo-Saxons. The Saxons were part of these Teutonic tribes, these Caucasian tribes that came across and invaded all of these countries in Western civilization. And for instance, Charlemagne he couldn't write his name. He was probably the strongest emperor there in the Middle Ages, in the West. What was going on in the Muslim countries? Well, they absorbed Greek culture a great deal. While the religion was in Arabic, the culture more and more after Alexander the Great, you remember reading that in your high school history books, Alexander the Great was in the late 300s BC, and he brought a Greek-type culture all across that area, which is now Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, those areas. He didn't care much about Saudi Arabia, and he probably wouldn't have been very welcome down there anyway. So he didn't go there. He didn't penetrate Saudi Arabia. But he did these other countries. And they became, in their life, in their culture, Greek-oriented. And they developed, now this is what we don't know, and we don't understand this, and for many years we didn't accept this at all, that it existed. But they developed a very high civilization, like in the 10th century, or 11th century. Their civilization was, they built great universities, they were top of everybody in the whole world, with maybe the exception of the Chinese, but in architecture. They built wonderful built palaces and things like that. They got medicine. They were absolutely marvelous in mathematics. And a whole lot of things that we call algebra and geometry today, they had invented back then. And so they were, here's one illustration. Thomas Aquinas was one of the great scholars in a very unscholarly century, the 12th and 13th century. Thomas Aquinas tried to explain Christianity in his philosophy. Now, he did know of Plato because the Christians carried on Plato. He had never heard of Aristotle. Now, guess where, and the Summa Theologica, which is his great work, that book is all parallel with Aristotle. So where did Thomas Aquinas get a knowledge of Aristotle? Out of Spain. And who gave it to him in Spain? The Jews. And where did the Jews get it? From the Muslims. They brought it across North Africa with a lot of other Greek culture. They were familiar with all of that. And I got to tell you, what we got to understand is these people became very highly educated, and they still are today. The Muslim people across the world are quite intellectual and quite brilliant people. And they know some stuff. And that's where Thomas Aquinas got familiar, because the Muslims gave it to the Jews. Incidentally, there was more than one caliph as time went on, and there was the big caliphate was in Baghdad for centuries, but then it spread elsewhere. And there was one in Spain, over there, in a town called Cordova, Spain, the caliphate. And they were for about 100 years, they were extremely tolerant of Christians and Jews. And that's why they shared their knowledge with Jews. And the Jews became very intellectual people, very competent in medicine, in the sciences, of arithmetic and geometry and that sort of thing, and architecture in particular. And then the caliphate in Cordova turned against the Jews and the Christians and outlawed them. But they had it, and that's where Thomas Aquinas acquired his knowledge of that. Now, jumping ahead, in the 1200s, when we were still in the Dark Ages, there was a group that arose in what is today Turkey called the Ottomans. And they created an empire and established a caliphate at Constantinople. And did you know this? While we were in the Dark Ages and gradually coming out of it, that the Muslim armies in the Ottoman Empire advanced all the way up the Danube River, right to the door of Vienna, Austria. And in 1529, they attacked Vienna, which was one of the marvelous cities in a not very marvelous century quote, the Western civilization. But the people in Vienna, the empire there, defeated them and pushed them back. But 100 years later, they were back again and attacked Vienna and tried to do it. But they lost in the 1700s. But by that time, Western civilization was coming out of what we call the Dark Ages, and they were coming and becoming popular, and the Industrial Revolution was right gonna come up. This was when you get the cotton gin, good things like that that were invented that revolutionized Western civilization and created abundant wealth in England and in France, Germany, and eventually in the United States. Now, the last time they attacked Vienna and were defeated, the American civilization and European civilization was gaining more and more strength coming out of the Dark Ages. And we had discovered the Greek culture, and we had then, we knew Aristotle and Plato on our own. We didn't have to get it from the Muslims anymore. Now, when the Ottoman Empire began to go into a decline, then gradually Western nations like England and France in particular moved into the Muslim countries. And this is called colonialism. And I'm jumping on up to the 20th century. The Muslim people, the Ottoman Empire, was getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And in World War I, they decided that Germany was going to win. So they backed Germany, and they lost. This is a major turning point in the whole Muslim world. And you need to have some knowledge of this if we're to understand what's going on in the world today, to make a proper assessment, and particularly from a Christian point of view. When we won World War I, they destroyed the caliphate in Constantinople and said there would be no more Muslim, no more Ottoman Empire. That's the death of it right there. And there was, at the same time that the Ottoman Empire was destroyed, there was a gradual growth, or a revival of some of the writings of Muslim scholars that went back to the 1300s even. Did you know that the word assassin is a Muslim word? It's an Arabic word. And we think of it as killing somebody, like a ruler. If you assassinate a ruler, then that word assassinate comes from an Arabic word. The only really word we use in common English that is a derivative of an Arabic word. But these people, there was a revival when the Ottoman Empire was dead after World War I. Then these much more militant Muslim people, and these were brilliant people. Now, there were about five or six of these guys that came to the United States in the early 20s and went to Harvard and Yale and Princeton and places like that and got very well educated, but they were afraid of the materialistic secularism of Western civilization. But they wanted our knowledge, and they went back home, and they wanted to rise, to build up a type of militant Muslim people, and they did. The word Saudi Arabia, Saudi was one of these men. His name was Ibn al-Saud, and he was in the 20s one of the leaders in Saudi Arabia. And the king, now king of Saudi Arabia, took his name from this scholar. And it was a very violent type of thing. What the League of Nations did was created a, what they call mandates. And this was going to be the end of colonialism. You say, well, why were the British and the French people, why did they want to do this? Why did they want to conquer these countries? Do you know, this is an interesting thing, that, do you know, in World War II, Franklin Roosevelt he landed planes to help the invading armies of the North Vietnamese people and gave them aid against what was originally the French army, because that was one of their colonies, was Saudi Arabia, Vietnam. And Roosevelt wanted to help end all colonialism, and so he helped the enemies, the people from, that eventually ruled Hanoi and shot down John McCain. But he wanted no French people to, after World War II, he did not want any colonialism to revive itself. And that's why he did that. I think that's kind of interesting. I might add at this same time, in 1917, the English people adopted a resolution called the Balfour Proclamation. And what the Balfour Proclamation did, it said, we will establish, at the end of the war, a Jewish state. I'll pick that up next week on that. Did the United States have any colonies? No. We were too late coming to the table, I guess. But we didn't have it. We weren't having any real interest in these Muslim countries, unlike England and France and Holland. Had no interest in them until the late 1920s, and the answer was oil. It was the Standard Oil of California that contracted with Saudi, King Saudi, to allow a contract in there. And of course, those desert people, they didn't know how to drill an oil well or any of that kind of thing. But the Standard Oil of California did. And in the late 1920s, they set up an operation and they discovered oil, they drilled for oil, and they owned most of the oil there. And later on, the Saudis took it back and said, you don't own it at all. Now, let me close it with this. Why is it that so many of the Muslim people today hate the United States and all Western civilization? These people are well educated, and they know their history. And so some of the reasons are the history that runs in their veins, the blood that goes through them, carries with it the lessons of history. And you see, the great civilization that they had went into decline. When we were dumb in the Dark Ages, they were brilliant. And they know that, and they believe that. And they feel that they have lost that, and they want it back. And we don't deserve it. They love to tell us that we taught Thomas Aquinas, our Aristotle. They did, I think it was in the 10th century, what's called the Dome of the Rock. You'll hear about that in the news occasionally. That's in Jerusalem. And that's one of the reasons why Jerusalem is such a difficult thing for us to solve, religiously and politically. Because the Dome of the Rock was, according to the Mohammedan religion, is where Abraham was taken up to heaven, right there in Jerusalem. And they built a mosque on top of the rock. And that's the Dome of the Rock, is a mosque. That's a Muslim mosque. And they don't want to give it up. And they remember that. And you Christians and you Jews think you own Jerusalem? No, you don't. We own Abraham. And it's ours. That's one of the reasons they hate us. I mentioned the notion that they can recall their great civilization. They can recall that they taught us algebra. They taught us medicine. They were doctors. They were good at all of this according to the knowledge of their time. I guess, I hadn't thought of this, but it would be like today, if you get the cancer, you need to go to MD Anderson over in Houston, or the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio, or Mayo's or something like that. Well, if you got the heebie-jeebie disease in the 1000s, you had to go to someplace in, say, what is today Iraq, and go to their doctors over there, because they knew some stuff, and all we were doing, practicing superstition in the Western civilizations. Another element in their history that they vividly remember is the Crusades. The Crusades, we organized people, armies, to go down and try to recapture Jerusalem and do that, and take it away from the Muslims. They ended up driving us out of there. We didn't hold up any of those things that we took over in the Crusades. We ended up losing. But it doesn't matter. It's the fact that we think we beat them there, and we didn't. And one of the great political mistakes, I'm sorry to say, was George Bush called it after 9/11, "We will do a great crusade." I don't know that he knew he shouldn't have used that word, but it burned into the hearts of those people, a crusade that reminded them of the crusades in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries of their civilization. Then they also have not forgotten that we destroyed the caliphates in Constantinople. And the last caliphate to go down the tube was in Spain at Cordova. To illustrate something, are you aware of the fact, you remember the controversy when some of the Muslims wanted to build a mosque in New York City, one block away from the towers that went down in flames in 9/11? Do you know what the name of the mosque that they were going to raise there, what the name of it is? Cordova. Now, if you think that doesn't burn in the hearts of these people, you've got to realize this fact. They want to reignite the glories of Cordova in Spain centuries before. The last thing I'll mention today about this is that they clearly feel, you see, when the Balfour Declaration proclaimed that all Western civilization is saying there will be a nation called Israel, the Balfour Declaration claims that the Israel nation will be in Palestine. And it didn't come into existence until the end of World War II, but it started in 1917. Well, do you realize that no Muslim country ever endorsed the Balfour Declaration? They didn't. They have never agreed to that. So they feel that the existence of Israel was what we rammed down their throats. They remember all of this. They know their history. They hate the missionaries. We sent missionaries. The Church of England sent missionaries all over there to try to make Christians out of these Muslim people. And they resented that. It's an interesting thing that people raise the question every once in a while. Why does not the people who are not militant Muslims, why do, when there is a, like the crashing of the towers in New York City, or the bombing in Boston recently, why does not the imams that are not militant people, why don't they raise up and say to their own people, this is wrong, what you're doing is wrong? They never do. Have you ever heard of a Muslim, of an imam in the Muslim religion, stand up and publicly denounce any of these atrocious things that we call terrorism? They don't do it. They're quiet. They don't say, but what do the people of the street do? Now recall your television scene. After 9/11, at that, do you know what the streets of Baghdad and all of these places like that, Cairo, Egypt, the masses of people were in the streets saying, down with America. Why? Because it's as if, as one says, right after 9/11, the day of our humiliation is over. Listen to that. The day of our humiliation is over. Now, these are not necessarily militant people, but they are in favor of what is being done, a revival of their greatness. And I have to tell you, their greatness was, in its own day, very great. Next week, we will talk about what is it that we are going to do about in all of this as Christians and as Western people. What do they demand? Number one, remove all military out of any Muslim country. Get out. Number two, no Christians or Jews would be allowed in Saudi Arabia. Do you realize there is a major jihad against Christians in the Coptic regions of Egypt today, killing? There will be no more State of Israel. You do not own our oil, and we resent you taking it. You try to set the price, and we're not going to let you do that. Well, think about this all during the week, and next week we will be centered totally on what do we think politically we can do about this, what policies should we adopt, and as Christians, what is our opinion of what should we do about the jihad against not only our civilization, but against our religion.